Hello and welcome to Baseball America's Draft Podcast. I'm Carlos Collazo, joined today by both Peter Flaherty and Jacob Rudner. We are here to kind of go back over our preseason draft teams. This was an exercise that myself, Jacob, Ben Badler did before the amateur season for 2025 kicked off. We each drafted teams of draft prospects in an attempt to make the best collections of talent that we could. Peter was not able to be involved in that exercise originally, so he'll serve as like a stand-in for Ben's team and also a judge and critic of our teams as we kind of work through it. But since we've started doing this exercise, I think it's always kind of fun to look back at our teams, see how we did, line up the bonus values for each of our teams and players, and then see how we stacked up with the best of the rest. So the players that we did not pick, but wound up with a lot of money. So I guess before we get into it properly, Peter, Jacob, how are you guys doing? I guess we'll start with you, Peter.
Yeah, doing all right. It's been quite the couple days. So I guess I hope that this podcast is a nice little palate cleanser for anyone out there that's looking for one. Kind of put your mind at ease and listen to us chop it up about some of these guys, because I know that's what it's serving as for me to an extent. So that's kind of where I'm at.
Jacob?
Yeah, doing well. I mean, it's the slow time for us on the college side, so it's good to be looking back, kind of. And I mean, personally, just not to get too far ahead of our conversation here, but I'm looking forward to dive in.
Feel free to dive right in.
I'm just looking forward to going through the best of the rest on this one, because I think that there are a lot of college players who we didn't talk about when we drafted these teams. We're going to go over this in more detail.
Just as you guys are listening, I'm going to put our teams in the podcast description so you can kind of visualize it. I know when we're talking about a lot of names and players, it maybe is tricky. So if you want to like look at the teams as we talk through it, that might be a helpful visual. But yeah, continue on, Jacob. Sorry.
No, I was just going to say, like, you look at some of the names that are on the best of the rest list that we're going to go over, and it's fascinating to me to think about what led to our process to maybe not select some of those guys, and maybe what happened throughout the college season or the high school season that led to them becoming more prominent draft prospects. So just we have a really interesting conversation coming up here.
Yeah, we do. I guess maybe is it worth kind of highlighting our teams, the teams we selected just at the forefront? I can run through it really quickly. I'll just go from left to right on our screen, or actually I might just go in the order, specific draft order. So I had the first pick, Ben drafted second, Jacob drafted third, and we had a snake order. We don't have the exact order here. I remember kind of the few players we went off to start, but we can get into that as we go through strategy. But the rosters were a catcher, two corner infielders, two middle infielders, three outfielders, four pitchers, and a utility player. We had to split up this team between college and high school. So I believe it was seven of college or high school, and then six of the other. So that's kind of how we outlined it, and we had some flexibility for where you could put players positionally. But my team was Ike Irish at catcher, Dean Curley at corner infield, Xavier Nines at corner infield. At middle infield, I had Eli Willits and Merrick Houston. In the outfield, I had Nick Dumanel, Slater DeBrunn, Kane Kepley. In the rotation, I had Jamie Arnold, Seth Hernandez, Landon Harmon, Cameron Appenzeller, and Iva Arquette was my utility. Ben's team at catcher, Caden Bodine. At corner infield, he had Trey Phelps and Ethan Holliday. At middle infield, he had Billy Carlson and Lucas Franco. In the outfield, he had Jace Laviolette, Cam Cannarella, Brendan Summerhill. In the rotation, he had Matt Scott, Justice DeJong, Josh Hammond, and Angel Cervantes. His utility player was Brock Sell. And then Jacob rounding us out at catcher, he had Luke Stevenson. At corner infield, he had Gavin Fien and Boston Kellner. At middle infield, he had Kason Cunningham and Brady Ebel. In the outfield, he had Devin Taylor, Henry Ford, Dean Moss, and his rotation was Tyler Bremner, Cruz Schoolcraft, Kyson Witherspoon, Cam Leiter, and his utility player was Brandon Compton. So those are kind of our teams here. Peter, since you are our kind of independent source, I mean, we can look at the bonuses and it paints one picture, but what is your just initial gut check feel? I know you probably had thoughts on this when it initially dropped, but looking back at it now, just thoughts on these teams that were assembled.
Yeah, so if I'm Ben, I'm bummed that the signability of my guys, I didn't quite necessarily have my finger on the pulse on that one, and a lot of them ended up going to school. But outside of that, it's interesting. You can kind of get a peek into what each of your guys' strategy might have been, because as we'll get into...
I'm curious, too, if you're... We might have discussed this in the last few months, but I'm curious what your perception is of each of our strategies, if you just looking at our teams here and knowing the draft order.
We've talked about it like ever so briefly in the lead up to the podcast and even in the lead up to this exercise a few months ago, like what your guys' strategy was, and even in the aftermath a little bit. But like, when, if you're listening and looking at the best of the rest and you see some of these prominent names, should I drop the names on the best of the rest
squad? Go for it. And the way I did this was I basically filtered signing bonus amounts and filled out the roster just purely with the highest signing bonus players that fit at each position. So there will be a couple middle infielders, corner infielders that got bigger bonuses, but I was trying to fill out the roster kind of the same way we did. So that's how the best of the rest was put together.
Yeah. So catcher is Michael Oliveto. The two corner infielders are Andrew Fisher and Ethan Petrie. The two middle infielders are JoJo Parker and Steele Hall.
Oof.
Outfield, you get Sean Gamble, Ethan Conrad, and Jaden Fausk. In a rotation, this is the big one.
This one hurts me.
The best of the rest squad has a rotation of Cade Anderson, Liam Doyle, Gage Wood, Patrick Forbes.
Yeah,
and rounding it out is the utility players, Gavin Keelan.
So last year we did the same exercise, and the best of the rest was better than everyone's team, marginally so. I think it was within $500,000 of signing bonus was better than the top team last year. This year, it's a lot more clear cut. The total signing bonus value of the best of the rest team is $57,800,000. Second best was my team this year at $51,400,000 in bonuses. Then we go Jacob, $38,800,000. And Ben, really bringing up the rear here with $29,800,000. So I think, like, just looking at it very clearly, last year, we had fewer misses of players that were inside the top 10 at the very top of the draft. I mean, the most obvious ones here are Cade Anderson, Liam Doyle, and JoJo Parker. And I'll give myself, I don't know if you want to give yourself grace here, Jacob. I'll let you speak for yourself. I'll give myself a little bit of grace for Cade Anderson and Liam Doyle because we didn't have them ranked quite as high. Maybe this is a message that we maybe should have. I know I talked to some scouts who were like, you seem kind of low on Cade Anderson. I think we had him in like second, third round range on our preseason list. Liam Doyle was kind of in a similar spot. But JoJo Parker, like looking at him there with how much I loved him in the course of the season, I'm looking at my team and I really liked my middle infield. And I don't know that there's an obvious player that I would have taken off in hindsight. Maybe I could have really tried to force JoJo on there at corner infield instead of Xavier Nyans. But man, I feel bad about not having picked JoJo given how much I liked him and obviously where he wound up going in the draft. But Jacob, what are your thoughts on all this?
I mean, the best of the rest pains me, especially in the pitching department. I will say though, one thing that I think is important with regard to Liam Doyle specifically, I don't know that you looked at what he had done over his previous 2 years in college at Coastal and Ole Miss, and it really jumped off the page to the point where it was like, I have to have this guy over, you know, Kyson Witherspoon, who he got more money than, or Jamie Arnold, who he beat in the draft. I mean, we picked a lot of pitchers who I think made sense at the time. Matt Scott made a lot of sense at the time, and that was maybe a riskier one that Ben had. But the reality is, Liam Doyle was coming off a season where he had, I think it was like a 5.7 ERA or something like that at Ole Miss. And then he comes back and he strikes out 165 guys and is one of the best pitchers in the country. Like, I'm not going to fault us too bad there. I think that to your point, the high school infielders that we left on the board are a little bit more disappointing. Other than that, I don't know that it's like too damning, because the reality is, if you look at the pitchers, the names are big in hindsight. At the time though, I can see very well like why those wouldn't have been selected in a reasonably short draft.
Right. And I think too, we could have selected probably every single one of the correct high school middle infielders, and there still would have been more that looked really good on the best of the rest, just because we don't have enough spots. And that was such a strong demographic for this year's class. As I'm looking at the list now, what stands out to me in the last 2 years that we've done this exercise, really, we need to really stop taking high school pitchers in this exercise. We have to save our pitching slots for the college players, because again, we had, between the three of us, we had 9 total misses. Of that 9, let's see, 1, 2, 3 of those were pitchers, high school pitchers, Justice DeJong and Angel Cervantes for Ben. And with Cervantes, maybe there's a little bit of an asterisk because he went in a really good spot. He was going to get paid a decent amount of money. It would have looked quite good if the Pirates had just done a little better job just securing the signability there with him. But then Cameron Appenzeller was my final pitcher pick. I really went into it thinking he was going to have like a Cruz Schoolcraft sort of track, like move up into that back of the first round sort of range. The buzz on him coming out of the summer was super high. But even looking back to last year, missing, let's see, William Schmidt, Tegan Coons, Chris Lavonis, William Kirk were all players that we missed on, myself and Ben, Ben and Peter. I didn't take any high school pitchers that year. I guess I forgot about the lesson learned. But it just highlights to me that the high school pitching demographic is so difficult for teams to really settle down and draft. Those players go to college a ton. And also, there is always this huge tier of college pitchers that are maybe not entering the year in the first round, but they have a lot. It seems like they have a lot better ability to move up the boards in the spring compared to the high school pitchers. Any thoughts on that idea maybe for either of you?
Jacob, you can take it if you want, but I mean, I think that the volatility of high school arms and the signability is a really good point. I mean, in looking at these two exercises in a vacuum, like, you know, it's obviously only a certain portion of the player pool, but I mean, I think it is interesting that in back-to-back years, you know, a handful of the guys that didn't end up signing are the prominent high school arms. And like that demographic in and of itself is a really kind of high risk demo to an extent, like especially with, you know, the high school right-hander you hear all the time. So, I mean, it kind of makes sense when you look at some of them. Like William Schmidt was really surprising in 24 when it was announced that he was going to go to LSU. I think it was just as, if not more surprising when Angel Cervantes was selected 51st overall and didn't end up reaching a deal with Pittsburgh. Like the others I can kind of see, like Tegan Coons, Lavonis from a surprise standpoint was right there with Cervantes, just also given where he went. Yep. So we've had like two kind of like unicorn almost cases in back-to-back years of guys being top two round picks and not signing. Like you probably have this stat off the top of your head, because I'm sure that can't even imagine how many times that you had to repeat it like on the draft show and in general, but like 97%,
it's like over 98%, yeah,
of top 10 round picks end up signing. And I'm sure that number even increases further when you isolate the top two rounds. So like those are two really unique cases in back-to-back years. But I'm with you. It's a volatile group of players, and kind of a dangerous one in general year after year. Like I'm sure it'll be the same in 26 and so on. So I don't necessarily see it changing too much. I would hope for a team's sake though, the drafting a guy in the second round and having him not sign trend is bucked though.
Yeah.
It is interesting though. And sorry, I'll jump in real quick here. Yeah. Carlos, I think one thing that is fascinating to me with regard to the college pitchers is there's a different type of volatility that exists, especially for an exercise like this. I think that there's a reasonably predictable group within the college demographic. Like you have the Bremners and the Witherspoons of the world, Jamie Arnold. And we knew, you know, really early before the season started, well before the season started, that those guys were going to be first round names, if not early first round names. But there is also, and you touched on this, a level of upwards mobility that exists in college that doesn't exist anywhere else. And Gage Wood, who is on our best of the rest list, is probably the best example of that. Gage Wood didn't even throw 40 innings this year. He threw 37 and two-thirds innings, the majority of which happened at the end of the year. And his best outing, of course, was the no-hitter that he threw in Omaha. And so that level of performance late allows these guys to move up fast. And so for anybody who's looking at the best of the rest and wondering, like, how did Gage Wood not get onto a team and he was one of the best pitchers in the country? Well, that's how. I mean, we didn't really even see him pitch during the season. And you can go back even further, like Cade Horton, Ty Floyd, all of these guys put together late season performances that I think did a lot for their draft stock on the college side. And that allows you to kind of shoot up the board. So there is an unpredictable nature to this. I think that it's a safer pick for the exercise we were trying to do, like you said, but it's also not a guarantee. And there is a range of college pitchers that exists that I don't think you can really account for before the season starts that emerges at some point, you know, towards the halfway mark, if not the end of the season.
Mm-hmm. What also stands out to me on this list is of the misses, almost all of them are high school players, which we talked about before. I think there's signability reasons for that and just the levers you're talking about of how you can increase your stock as a college player just affords more opportunity to move up the board. But two of the college misses were draft-eligible sophomores. Trey Phelps for Ben, his corner infield pick, and then Henry Ford for Jacob, one of his outfield picks. Both are players who just did not have the sort of seasons that they were expecting, that we were expecting. And as a draft eligible sophomore, you just have more leverage. It's kind of a similar conversation with the high school players. Those players have more leverage. They can afford to stick bigger price tags out for themselves in the draft and actually stick to that versus a college junior who maybe has a little bit more risk in running it back. And maybe that leads to an interesting conversation about Matt Scott, because he obviously did not have a good year and is transferring and kind of doing the Jared Spencer situation, the Ryan Prager situation. Like, there are some players who do this each year. It's tough because I wish Ben was here to talk through his strategy, but I wanted to highlight Ben because I feel like he has a much different view of this exercise, because he's talked to me before about it. He has a long time horizon. He wants his team to look good in 5-10 years. So I don't think he would be too upset about having so many high school players who are going to college. A player that he had last year that he didn't get credit for in this exercise was Brennan Lawson, who didn't sign and went to college. And that could look like a really good pick for him if we're looking at these teams in 5 to 10 years. But I do think it's interesting that Ben does our high school underclass rankings, and just the difference in his looks on high school players when he's watching them as underclassmen versus how they perform the summer prior to their summer or their senior season and into the fall of their senior season. I think those players can change their draft stock so significantly in this period. And it is always fascinating to me just like figuring out who are the players that Ben is still particularly high on who just came off down years, and how sticky that is with the industry on the high school side in particular, because that window of evaluation for these high school players at Area Code Games, at East Coast Pro, at some of these big high school showcases, it's so important for how teams are modeling these players out and how confident they're going to be in putting real money behind them in the draft next year. I think it's just worth maybe emphasizing for the high school players how quickly their picture can change, and how obviously at this age there's a lot of development going on. So it's a bold and a risky strategy for Ben, but I guess one we'll have to revisit in 10 years to see if some of these guys look quite good. And maybe also worth highlighting, he took a Stanford commit for his utility pick in Brock Sell. And that's risky business. I'm not sure if anyone's going to take Tyler Spangler coming up this year because he's just in a different spot ranking wise. But Stanford is maybe the school I would steer away from in an exercise like this.
If there's one school that has an 80 grade track record of retaining guys in their respective recruiting classes, it's Stanford. Like, Los, we touched on it in the last draft podcast and it led me down a wormhole to try and get the exact number. But I think that they've only had one or maybe two high school commits that they lose mm-hmm. to the draft, like as high schoolers, in the last, I don't know, 8 to maybe 10 recruiting cycles. It really is remarkable. Mm-hmm. And they're not like, these recruiting classes are legit on a national level. Like, it's not, you know, an unfair comparison, kind of an apples to oranges type of deal where you're taking maybe a crop of lesser known, not high caliber prospects and comparing it to, you know, like an LSU or Tennessee. Like, Stanford mm-hmm. is right there in terms of talent with these other schools, maybe a tier below.
Yeah.
In most years, but consistently put together top 25 recruiting classes, and their ability to retain is really impressive. Not that it's all that necessarily difficult to sell Stanford and mm-hmm. what the player is getting, not just for his 2, 3, 4 years there, but for the 40 years after it. But in today's day and age, it's been really impressive to see how it's held up over time.
Yeah. Jacob, or go ahead if you had something to add to that.
I was going to say, I mean, this is a little bit hypothetical here, but kind of an interesting thought that prompted for me. I do wonder how things change at Stanford for two reasons over the course of the next couple of years. One, being in the ACC is going to be a strain. And I do wonder if there are players who look at Stanford and have different opinions about what that structure is like and being a part of that, and whether or not that influences the thinking. I'm not saying that I think it will or won't. I'm just saying that is a data point worth considering. And the other thing is, head coach David Esker is in his 60s. He's been coaching college baseball since the 2000s. The last couple of years at Stanford have been rough. I don't necessarily think that they're going to get better anytime soon now that they're in the conference situation that they're in. There's a level of volatility to the Stanford situation that I think is interesting. If the coaching staff does change, and I'm not saying that's imminent, but if it does Stanford's status as this like mega draft retainer that doesn't really lose a whole lot of guys in the high school process, does that change? And what does that look like moving forward? So it's like, to your point, does the risk go down as we get, you know, deeper and deeper into Stanford being in the ACC over the next couple of years? That was a distracting comment and maybe better for the college podcast, but now that we're, we're teaming up here. So that is a thought that comes to my mind immediately.
Yeah, no, I'm happy to just go with wherever the conversation goes, because it is interesting. And I do wonder if Tyler Spangler next year will be just an interesting kind of test case for exactly how sticky is the Stanford commitment, because I think me and Peter were talking about it in a previous draft podcast, but I can't remember a Stanford commit ranked this high at this point in the calendar at a demographic that is not one that I think of as, oh, this is a risky demographic to get to campus. This is a high school shortstop at the very top of the draft board, left-handed hitter. That's another check for him. And just in terms of like the biomarkers we're looking at, the teams really appreciate, like, the elite high school shortstops in any class almost always go and get signed. Maybe it's interesting to look at him on a board here, three spots separated from Brock Chalowski, because him in high school, we probably would have been saying a lot of the same things. Now, I do think Tyler Spangler is in a different sort of tier at the same age and at the same time, particularly offensively. I think there's a lot more conviction in what he can do with the bat as a high school hitter versus maybe Rock at the same time. But you can see the sort of impact player you can get at the college level with one of these West Coast powers. So those two, I think, are just kind of interesting as maybe mirrors of each other in some way. And it just feels very unlikely to me that a team is going to let Tyler Spangler get to campus. But I guess we'll see how tricky and powerful that Stanford commit really is.
I was going to say, if Tyler Spangler isn't the one to buck this Stanford trend, then who knows who it'll end up being. Right. Like, obviously, there are so many variables from, like, player to player, and who knows. There's a world, albeit an unlikely one, in which Tyler Spangler makes it to campus and another one of Stanford's commits ends up getting poached. I doubt it, but, yeah, I mean, with Spangler, not to get off the topic too much here, like, big league body, tools, up the middle profile, left-handed, like, man, he checks a lot of boxes. And it's a really good high school shortstop class. It's a good infield class in general. On the college side as well, it's loaded with Rock Chalowski and Justin LeBron, Eric Becker, Tyler Bell up towards the top. Like, he, at least at the high school level, he's probably my shortstop two, and in general, like, he's a top five shortstop in the class, which, you know, he's an argument to be a potential top five, 10 or so overall pick. But it'll be really interesting and fascinating to follow it in the lead up to the draft and what the smoke is and things like that, because you start to get a feel, albeit really late in the cycle, like June, early July, like, as to what a kid's signability is. And I guess, not to go in so many different directions here, but, like, I do see what Ben is doing. Like, I mean, to touch on some of the, quote, misses from last year, you brought up Brendan Lawson, like, an argument to potentially go 1-1 in 27. Derek Curiel was another miss, chance to go in the top 15 or so overall in 26 as a draft-eligible sophomore. Tegan Coons was excellent at Tennessee and showed really well this summer. So, I mean, like, I see the vision there with Ben, and I'm lucky that I can kind of Monday morning quarterback this, because I wasn't in the draft room and making these picks, but I would have loved to have picked his brain a little bit on the pitching side, like, why some of the arms, particularly Matt Scott and Justice DeYoung, like, over Cade Anderson if he was still there. Liam Doyle. Obviously, yeah, Gage Wood is not like Gage Wood yet, but
I'm assuming. So next year, I'll have to just track the actual pick capital so we can say exactly when players were taken. But both myself and Jacob were pretty aggressive early on with pitchers. Like, we took four pitchers off the board in the first two rounds. And so to me,
I think I took three. If I remember correctly, Kyson was my third pick too. So.
Gotcha. Yeah. So once those are all off the board, I think Ben was in a position where he can kind of wait because he knew we weren't going to be taking two more arms. And so he just, it's just kind of how the board worked for him. And then once you get to the Matt Scott, Justice Zhang, Josh Hammond, funny thing about him as a pitcher now, given what he did with the bat, and Cervantes, like all those guys are kind of in the same tier as like a Landon Harmon, Cameron Appenzeller, and Cam Leiter, which were the pitchers that, that me and Jacob rounded out our rotation. So I'm sure just that focus for us in the first two rounds is part of that. Jacob, I'm curious now for your team, which are the picks that you're like really happy about in hindsight? And are there any in particular that you could take back now and you regret? Because I definitely have a couple from my team that jump out to me, but I want to give you a chance. And I can also go first if you want some more time to think through
your names.
We spend a lot of time on the road. We are often concerned about our online security when you're logging in from all over the globe, really. So you should maybe look into a VPN. What does that stand for, Kratz?
Virtual private network.
Boom. Nailed it. And that virtual private network that you should look into is called Surfshark. It is time to take control of your online security and try Surfshark today. You can enjoy their 30-day money-back guarantee and secure your digital world right now by visiting the link that we'll post there for you and start surfing securely. Surfshark.com/foul or the code foul at checkout will get you 4 extra months of Surfshark VPN, aka virtual private network. It's a risk-free 30-day money-back guarantee. Surfshark's unique VPN benefits include use on unlimited devices in 100 countries and 24/7 support at surfshark.com/foul. This has been your tech update. Keep your data safe.
Hiring the right people fast keeps your team moving forward without losing momentum. Every day a position stays open is a day you're missing productivity, creativity, and growth. When it comes to hiring, Indeed is all you need. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. Indeed Sponsored Jobs helps you stand out and hire fast. With Sponsored Jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates so you can reach the people you want faster. And it makes a huge difference. According to Indeed data, Sponsored Jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. One thing I love about Indeed is that it makes hiring so fast because it allows you to rapidly sort through candidates based on your preferences. Plus, with Indeed sponsored jobs, there are no monthly subscriptions, no long-term contracts, and you only pay for results. How fast is Indeed? In the minute I've been talking to you, 23 hires were made on Indeed, according to Indeed data worldwide. There's no need to wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. Listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/baseballamerica. Just go to Indeed.com/baseballamerica right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/baseballamerica. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring, Indeed is all you need.
Yeah. I'm ready. So one that I'm really happy about, but I will say, and maybe surprised to a degree, maybe not totally surprised just based on performance, but I thought Luke Stevenson would get more money than he did. I thought that that would count for me a little bit better. I mean, you had a $4.4 million catcher in Ike Irish. I thought I had a chance to be a lot closer to that with Luke Stevenson.
I would agree. Do you remember the order of our catchers? Because they were all pretty quick, and I don't even remember if I...
went first, I went second, and Ben got Bodine third. And and I will say, to our credit, those were the top they remained catchers, the three catchers. So I think we did well there. I was happy with that pick. I wish it netted me a little bit more value than it did, but I was happy with it. Bremner and Kyson are two picks that I really like, and I've talked about that on the college podcast and the fantasy podcast about how I think Bremner maybe got a little bit of hate during the real draft when he went as early as he did.
Agreed.
And I think that that was a win for me. Picks that I regret, maybe would have not gone with Schoolcraft. I mean, we talked about why college pitchers would be the way to go. Cam Leiter kind of falls into a weird category for me too, just because like he didn't pitch at all. I took that pick, and I even said it on that podcast episode that I made that pick hoping that he would throw a couple innings at least in 2025, and that never ended up happening. So, in hindsight, if I knew that he wasn't going to throw, which I had an inkling could happen, I probably wouldn't have made that pick. Henry Ford is kind of a weird one too. I mean, he didn't sign, which was unexpected. I thought he would. Again, do I go back and like regret that? Maybe a little bit. And I'll actually save this one for Peter because I took Boston Kelner for Peter. And that netted me a big fat zero. So I blame Pete for that pick. But other than that, I'm really pretty satisfied. I mean, I think it's a good group. Yeah. I think that there are a lot of names that could end up looking better than their dollar values look, for the sake of this exercise. Like Brandon Compton falls in that category a little bit for me. Luke Stevenson is definitely there. Maybe Brady Ebel, although that I could go either way on. Mm-hmm. I'm happy with the group, generally speaking. Like if I had to review my work at this point in the year, I think it's generally I would like redo most of it, and maybe with a couple exceptions, but it's pretty much exactly what I would have wanted.
Cool. No, go ahead, Peter.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, like, it's fun to sit back and, like, see and hear your guys' rationale, because it's like you can kind of pick out a player sort of archetype that you're a fan of, and it's somewhat apparent to see in the draft strategy, because obviously the bonus and signability aspect of it is part of the exercise, but outside of that, it's getting the top guys on your hypothetical board. So it's interesting to see like the audibles that may have been called if a guy got nabbed. I know on the pitching side with Ulos, like we see these, the quartet of arms that went unselected, but I know Jamie Arnold was right there with and was perhaps your top college arm. Seth Hernandez was your top arm in the class. You got your two guys, like Landon Harmon's ceiling is exceptional. Same thing can be said for Cameron Appenzeller, even though he didn't end up signing. Like projection left-hander stuff's got a chance to really tick up along with the velo. Like there's a chance in a couple of years he's right there in the mix to be a first round pick again. And then with you, Jacob, like I think you hit the nail on the head with Bremner, and I said this on the Hot Sheet show after the draft, like people kind of forgot along the way how good of a pitcher Tyler Bremner is. Like he's an outstanding arm talent. And Cruz Schoolcraft, 6'8" lefty, lead extension. Kyson Witherspoon is another excellent arm, and Cam Leiter is the biggest wild card of the group. And I have to assume he was taken at or near the end of this exercise. And I'm a huge fan of that pick on a flyer.
I believe he was my last pick, actually.
Yeah. Like there's a world in which he's healthy this college season. And is excellent for Florida State, and people are talking about him as one of the top college arms in the draft and a slam dunk first round pick. Like the stuff is off the charts with him. He's just got to stay on the field. So that's a great value pick, I think, in getting him for $1.3 million. I think, I'm kind of just bouncing around a little bit with thoughts that pop into my head.
Yeah, in real time. I can jump in and talk through a couple of my picks.
Yeah, go for it.
So I definitely had a specific strategy this year, and I think I would replicate that strategy in hindsight. I liked going after a few pitchers that I felt were locks at the top, and that was Jamie Arnold and Seth Hernandez, respectively. I like kind of to Jacob's point about Luke Stevenson, I'm a little bummed that Jamie Arnold is only giving me $5.9 million. That's definitely towards the lower end of like my expectations for where he would go. Going right outside of the top 10, I would have told you that really unlikely for that to happen at the time of this draft. But that said, like still pretty safe pick. I'm still happy with the return there. I was thrilled with my entire infield immediately after the draft, and I'm still happy with it now, but after the first 3 weeks of the season, this infield was looking like I was going to get maybe like six top 10 picks. Both Dean Curley and Merrick Houston were just lights out early on and then faded down the stretch. And then Eli Willits, obviously moving up into number one pick on the board. I think my personal best pick of the draft was Iva Arquette. He was my last pick. And I think it just happened because all the other middle infield slots got filled earlier and he was just kind of sitting there. So I was just waiting to take him later on. I'm not exactly sure how he kept getting passed over. Like for Ben to put him in the utility spot, it would have made a lot of sense. So I'm happy.
Can I interrupt you on that actually?
Yeah.
I remember how that happened. One thing that I think is really important for people to understand if you didn't hear that episode, and I recommend going back and listening to it.
Yeah.
The way we have to draft, there is a total of high school and college players that you have to fill.
You're right.
And for me personally, and I can't speak for Ben, I didn't even have room to draft Iva Arquette because I filled my college spot so quickly. I did. And I used three of them on pitchers. So I got to a point where it got really hard for me. And then I ended up having to use my infield spots for high school players. And so if I were to if that to me is a really good conversation, if I was to redo this, I would redistribute where I picked what in terms of high school and college, because I absolutely would have had an Iva Arquette earlier in the draft if I planned that out better in terms of distribution.
It's a great point.
I think that strategy, it was 100% the factor, because I believe Ben also went really college heavy early. I believe his first two picks were Jace LaViolette and Cam Cannarella. He had Ethan Holliday first, I think, and then his next two were LaViolette and Cam Cannarella. So that is certainly a factor at play. And for me, it's always interesting to try and look through where the strengths and weaknesses are demographically. And then I was really trying to get Seth Hernandez because it would fill a high school spot for me. He was in a tier of his own, I felt, in the class, and was good enough to where I didn't have any questions about signability. Was he going to get signed? Something like that. So that's a real factor there. The one that maybe I regret the most here, I have two. Cameron Appenzeller, I think, probably just falls into that tier of high school pitcher where it's just a little sketchy on whether or not he's actually going to sign and get to campus. So I think moving forward, I'll maybe be a little bit more conservative with taking those high school pitchers in this sort of exercise. Just because, again, it seems like you can get a lot more value by taking a shot on one of the college pitchers in a similar range. And then my other pick that probably looks the worst outside of Appenzeller, giving me a big zero, is Nick Dumanel in the outfield. He went in the 7th or 8th round. I don't remember off the top of my head what the round range was, but it was just a $200,000 signing bonus. Looking at the other players I had available, I really wish I could have gotten a Devin Taylor, who Jacob took on his team. Just the confidence
that's our guy.
he is. And I'm not exactly sure when you took Taylor, looking at the board now, if I ever had a real shot to get him. But a Taylor or a Brendan Summerhill over a Nick Dumanel, just players that maybe had a little more confidence in their pure hitting ability, the conferences and the programs that they'd done it with, just to make them a little bit more sticky at the top of the board. And even a guy like Ethan Petrie, I imagine we could have drafted him as an outfielder or a corner infielder. Him being on the best of the rest with his hitting track record just being so good, that's another one that I probably would do over in hindsight.
There's one guy I want to talk about in particular with you guys, because here's another element of this exercise that I think is really fascinating. There is a degree of how do agents influence the process here? Because I think that there is an element, excuse my language, of getting screwed on guys who should have gone a lot higher and made a lot more money, but didn't. And the poster child of that in this year's version is absolutely Brendan Summerhill to me. Because I've heard from sources, I've had many conversations that did not go as planned on draft night. And there were a lot of people who thought he was going to go sooner. So
we had him in the first round, basically every mock we did. So were some whispers that came up with Summerhill leading up. And I was like, hey, are you guys worried about him falling? And everything was no.
And he just fell.
Too good of a hitter, too good of a profile. We think he's going. So
I just to see him at one point, basically, we'll call it $2 million just for the, it's right there.
Yeah, they used the signing number, contingency bonus for him.
That could have been doubled, just based on the player. So that is another weird aspect of this. You are kind of trying to bet who's going to perform well on the business side of all of this.
There is a lot of games there. I guess you could look at this exercise in two ways. And I know Ben is on the far extreme. He cares far less about the actual bonus values we're looking at today than he does just his pure conviction that he took players that are going to be good in 5-10 years down the line. And there is a lot of gamesmanship if the end goal for us is acquire a team that has the best total signing bonus value. Those are two different goals. And I think there's a lot of gamesmanship and kind of scouting the industry and understanding the, like you said, there are some agents and agencies that are much more willing to send their high school players to college if they don't get what they want. There are a lot of a lot of agencies that are much more willing to strike a deal on draft day. And so like knowing that can obviously influence the players you're taking. So I think it's just a really fun exercise on the whole. It's a fun way to talk through the players. Cool to look back on now in hindsight. Giving Ben another short-term L, but he's got a big real-life W in real life with the new baby. So hopefully everything's going well with him. Maybe we can pick his brain at a later date. But we've been going for about 40 minutes. I'm happy to go longer if you guys have any other thoughts, comments, anything you want to get into. But also curious if you guys listening have any thoughts on this. Let us know on all the various socials that we can be found at. But Peter, I'll go to you first.
Yeah, not to be a dead horse. I keep wrestling between you and Jacob for like the team I want to give the crown to. Ben has the W somehow with the new child, so he has us beat by an immeasurable amount. So I guess the second place with an asterisk, but you got a whole lot of like Peter cheese balls on your squad, Los. Like an outfield that includes Slater, DeBron, and Kane Kepley.
Mm-hmm.
Love it. If I were picking one, I would like. I'm really happy Jacob brought up the point of I think it was six high schoolers and six college guys that we had to pick.
You have to do a minimum of six of either, and because we're drafting 13 total players, it's not even. So you can kind of pick how you want to do that.
Yeah.
So that was a really important point to bring up. So like
Peter, as you're talking, you're picking. I mean, you were earliest on the Cade Anderson bandwagon. If you're in this draft, we go deeper, obviously. But does Cade Anderson get picked if you're in this draft? Were you that high on him preseason? I don't remember.
He would have been on team Flaherty. Okay. But if I were picking one, it would have been between Cade and
Cade. Anderson. There's no way you would have picked Cade first overall preseason.
Oh, preseason? No.
Oh, in hindsight. Gotcha. Yeah.
Yeah, in this exercise, yeah. It would have been Cade Anderson or Eli Willits with my first pick. Now preseason, I thought Cade Anderson was a great arm. Would not have thought of it before.
Yeah.
But I think the high school strategy would have played into it and trying to fill my quota of high school guys. So I may have gone Willits. Also world in which I go with Anderson, like high school guys that I would have had circled and wanted. Slater, DeBron, no doubt on there. Angel Cervantes, no doubt on there. Seth Hernandez, I wouldn't have gotten Seth Hernandez with you picking.
Hey, I don't know. If you pick first, if you picked in front of me, you might have had a shot at him.
Yeah.
I was terrified he was going to get taken. I was hopeful that Ben's just hesitancy on arms in general would steer him away. Jacob was a wild card, obviously, doing it with him this year, so I wasn't sure.
Steele Hall and JoJo Parker obviously fit in that bucket too, and a few like Gavin Fien is another obvious one. So mm-hmm. they would have fit in there. Like if I were picking last and I, or you know, towards the end of it, and there wasn't like a clear cut guy that I wanted still available, like Charles Davalon, who was not even on the the best of the rest team, would have come into play. Like he was, I mean, his season was excellent and catapulted him to the position in which he was drafted. But even talking it through, I see where all of you guys were at. I'm kind of shocked. Kate, like it's interesting, but you know, we'll see which team looks the best in 2, 3, 4, 5 years, maybe.
Yeah,
a little bit longer with Team Battler, but in 2024 is 2024 squad's looking great. So
yeah, we'll have to make sure you are on for next year's exercise. It'll be a lot of fun to do it with four people. We've never done it with that many. I imagine the strategy and just the scarcity of different demographics would make it a lot more interesting. But Jacob, for you, final thoughts on this exercise?
I mean, I find myself still really compelled by just the undrafted players that we had. Like you run through that list and it is a really good group. Andrew Fisher, Ethan Petrie, JoJo Parker, Steele Hall, the entire rotation, Anderson, Doyle, Wood, Forbes. And it just does go to show you like the amount of movement that occurs. I think this is a really good case study for that. Like you have the guys on all three teams that I think were relatively obvious early picks. Maybe there were a couple of flyers that we took, like Cam Leiter for me is a good example of that. But it is a really good reflection of where the industry kind of stood in the preseason. And the best of the rest is a great look at how things shift over the course of the year, especially on the college side with arms. And it makes you think, like next year when we redo this exercise, is there a way to better account for that demographic, the mm-hmm. group that's going to rise and be in that $5+ million conversation? Because just looking at it really quickly, there are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 guys on the best of the rest team that signed for $5+. So
yep.
that's a big number. And I am curious.
There were three top 10, right? And then
yeah.
both, maybe actually 4. Steele Hall was in the top 10, and then Gavin Keelan was right outside of it.
Right. And so for me, like, how do we narrow that gap is what is my biggest takeaway from this. And what yeah. does cause that level of rise? And for a guy like Gage Wood, maybe it's a little bit more unpredictable because of how his season went, and it really did come late and out of nowhere. But, like, mm-hmm. I think the end of the year conversation was that Gage Wood had one of, if not the best fastballs in the draft. And so being able to do better predicting of those things, I think, will be the goal mm-hmm. for next year. And I think that best of the rest team, like, to me, really stands out. Like, that it is a really good mm-hmm. group.
Yeah. I wonder how much of it is just yearly. Sometimes there are players that we can't predict. Mm-hmm. Looking at the 2024 draft, we did much better in terms of not missing guys at the very top. I don't think there was a single player taken inside of the top 10 who we didn't have selected on one of these three teams. Actually, I lied. Christian Moore was the highest selected player, Cam Smith, just after the top 10. And then Gerangelo Saintia and Treya Savage, kind of middle of the first round. But definitely the best of the rest team this year looks a lot more impressive just in terms of, like, immediate signing bonus value, draft capital.
There's also a way to look at this as well that I think, you know, our exercise does a really good job of painting this. One of the conversations that the three of us have had a lot over the course of the last calendar year was about how the 2025 draft group was kind of a hodgepodge at the top. Mm. And there was a lot yeah. of unpredictability about who was going to emerge as the best prospects, high school and college, in this draft. And that reigned true all the way through the draft process. And I think that it is especially reflected in how we kind of organized things preseason and the players that we pursued in this mm-hmm. exercise. It really does demonstrate to me the level of volatility that existed in 2025. And I think that as we continue to do this over the next couple of years, hopefully, well, I do wonder if 2025 will stand alone for that best of the rest team and how that kind of compares as we
for sure.
have a bigger sample size of this game that we play.
How productive of an exercise, and this is, now we're like, we might as well just be slacking out loud. Like, how productive of an exercise do you think it would be to do, like, even like an abridged version of this in January, early February, before the college season kicks off, and then another one in July and see how it shifts? Like, I'm just thinking,
like, redraft it. I think that could be interesting.
Completely counterproductive, but
yeah,
in terms of Jacob's thoughts of sort of projecting it a little bit. And
I think if we did that, it would probably just give, it would just reinforce the idea we've been talking about of just how quickly things change. I mean, we try and highlight this by having, like, 5 in-season updates on the draft board and constantly tinkering with it and tweaking it. Like, I think just constant iteration of the list is just the best way to get to the best possible list we can at the end of the day. But maybe doing, like, a mid-season revisit of the draft and redrafting will put another, like, bold highlight on the fact that it just does change so rapidly at this level.
I'm with you. That's a good point. And as you guys were drafting, an insight to your strategy, were you like, I would have been married to my own process, which is, like, taking the best guys on my personal board, for better or worse. But throughout the exercise, were you guys drafting off your own, like, pref list, so to speak, or
no.
also trying to take into account, like, bonus and trying to rack up, like, the largest, like,
I've only ever
sum of signing bonuses in the end?
There are some players that I always like a little bit better than I think the industry likes. I feel like I have a decent idea of, like, where the deltas are between, like, my personal guys I like versus the industry. And I always go with the industry because I know we're going to revisit this at the end of the year and the signing bonus values of the industry are going to come in play here and, like, how we're looking at it. And I also just think, like, I would rather defer to the industry. Like, that's kind of how we make our list. So that's kind of how I do it. And I also think, too, it's difficult because so much of what I think about these players are informed by my conversations with the scouts. So if I haven't seen the players in person, my view of the players largely just influenced by reporting, I would say. So,
yeah. Cause, like, last year, in terms of the, like, racking up signing bonuses, like, I ended up picking PJ Morlando begrudgingly, and that was like a $3.4 million bonus, and obviously played well with my final number, but like I didn't like the pick.
He was a model pick. You were an area scout, and he was a model pick the team took that you were like, eh, okay.
God bless. Yeah, I didn't love it then. I don't like it now. But
final ending shots at PJ from Peter here on the pod.
PJ Morlando catching strays at the end of the podcast.
For no reason, I feel bad. But it's interesting to like look back at, because I'm trying to like recall my own strategy when we did this in 2024. It's a really fun exercise, though. I do enjoy it because. Mm-hmm. It's fun strategy. You get scouting and like, you know, it's very fun.
It's a nice excuse to talk through the players in a way that's maybe a little bit more entertaining for people. So, well, cool.
One last like fun question, okay, not to keep tracking this on.
You're good.
I know Jacob had his kind of wild card pick with Cam Leiter, like a flyer pick. Ben, I don't want to assume and speak for him. He could have with a couple of the guys. I know if Jeff were in the exercise, he would have had a couple off the board picks. Los.
Jeff definitely would have made sure Steel Hall was not in the best of the rest. Tell you that with confidence at the preseason. He would have taken Steel Hall.
Oh, yeah. He's posing with Steel Hall on the stage with a Team Ponce jersey, probably within the first couple of picks of the draft. But were you thinking of any guys kind of not off the beaten path necessarily, but like wild card guys towards the end? That you were going
to
nab.
I mean, I really tried to draft in such a way that I would avoid that. And I think that's partially how I wound up with Ivar Arquette, because I just had so many high school guys that I really liked early on that I was able to not have that. Like, you have to draft a prep issue now. The one that I kind of point to is maybe Kane Kepley. Like, I wasn't too excited about the outfield capital once Laviolette, Cannarella, Summerhill, and Taylor off the board. I guess I throw Slater to Brennan there as well that I got, but like there were a lot of outfielders that I was probably considering for that Kane Kepley one, and his profile just felt a bit safe to me. So that's kind of how I went with him. I liked the OBP and just the up the middle profile for him. So he was maybe the biggest dart throw, but really looking at my board now, like it was fairly stock for better or worse, I think, at the time.
I think that's, you know, I think that actually is a testament to how well you ended up going about the exercise. Cause like where you had someone like Ivar Arquette fall on your lap at the end.
I mean, he was the second biggest, third biggest bonus that I had. My top three were Eli Willits, Seth Hernandez, Ivar Arquette. I'll take that.
Yeah, man. That duo of DeBrun and Kepley. That's huge fan. Huge fan.
Cool. Well, I think that's going to wrap it up for this episode of the podcast. Hope you guys enjoyed. Like I said, kind of the slow period for amateur season, but we got a lot of review content in the works. I know both Jacob and Peter have been putting in the work on just our typical off-season content, a lot of stuff that we haven't had in the past on the site as well. There's plenty of pro stuff going on the site. We're getting it on prospect handbook mode. So still plenty of things going on for us at Baseball America, even if it is not the kind of crazy period that we have from February through July. So hope you guys are having a good time. Check us out next week, I believe, College Podcast. Next week in the works.
Tuesday. Yeah,
for Peter. Tuesday it is. For Peter, for Jacob, I'm Carlos. Thank you guys for following and supporting. We will see you next time.